From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Ann Strainchamps in for Jim Fleming, and today we're telling ghost stories.
Every night as the universe closes its eyes, the gods sit down to read a story.
Writer Patrick Rothfuss with a story from listener Joanna Truman.
These are not the sort of stories we know as ghost stories. The ones told only when the temperature drops and the leaves turn colors. Upon these pages, our history is written. Lives cut short or left too long, and those that end precisely when they should. The gods are fascinated by our attempts to understand it. They love our whispered tales by firelight, our ghost tours, our seances, our electromagnetic field readings, our bedsheet costumes. But most of all, they love our stories.
This is a story about a boy who became very lost. It's a story about the girl who helped him find his way. Then she left him on his own. Then she died. It's a story about spending 20 years of your life trying to forget 1 year of your life. It's a story about ghosts. It's a story about being trapped in time. It's a story about what it means to be haunted.
That's Eric Newsom. He's a writer and a public radio colleague, well, a public radio boss, actually. He's NPR's vice president for programming. And that's how he begins his new memoir called Giving Up the Ghost. And in this story, which is true, Eric admits that for years he was scared of ghosts. Not just a little creeped out by them, but really terrified.
Yeah, I tried to keep it hidden, and many of my friends thought it was a joke. If you say you're scared of heights, people don't start talking about tall buildings. If you say you're an alcoholic, people don't tell you how much they love booze. But when you say you're scared of ghosts, people want to tell you ghost stories.
It's a little unkind.
Yeah, and it's horrifying. But for me, I just went out of my way to avoid anything involving ghosts. A trailer for a scary movie, Halloween stuff. I would just go out of my way just to avoid it. Or if even just walking down the street, someone commented, oh, that house is haunted. People hear noises in it all the time. I would go across the street. I didn't want to walk on the sidewalk in front of the place.
Of course, in some ways, we're all haunted, right? By memories, regrets, people we've lost. But your story revolves around two specific ghosts, one real girl and one ghost that you saw or thought maybe you saw from the time you were a kid, the one you called the little girl in blue?
Yeah, little girl in a blue dress. She never had a name to me. I just always thought of her as being that. We moved into a house in Canton, Ohio. It was a nice house, you know, three-bedroom, four-bedroom house, you know, colonial, kind of typical. But it was old, and it made a lot of creaky noises, as old houses do.
And you were how old?
I was 10 or 11 when we moved into that house, and almost immediately we could start hearing noises upstairs, like a thudding sound. And we thought it was the cat jumping around on the furniture upstairs. And then we realized that we were hearing these thudding sounds, and the cat was right there with us. So obviously it wasn't her, so we never could figure out what it was. And as I entered my preteens, I started to have a regular recurring dream of seeing this little girl in a blue dress at the end of a pathway. And as I approach her, she starts to try to speak to me, but it's either in some foreign language or gibberish or something. It just makes no sense to me. And as we get closer and closer, she seems more frantic to want to tell me something. And then I'd wake up. But I always had this feeling when I woke up that she was there.
And this was scary?
It was horrifying. There was something she was trying to warn me about, or she was trying to harm me, or there was something bad associated with this. You know, at the same time, you know, I'm kind of like this dorky outcast kid having increasing trouble with social connections with people, increasingly depressed, and all this kind of cycled in on itself. And that's where the other girl comes into the story, which is my friend Laura, who, as I was kind of cutting myself off or losing my connection with almost everyone else in the world, she was the one constant. Many nights of the week, the two of us would just, you know, it's Canton, Ohio, we're teenagers, we have no money, we have nowhere to go, we have nothing to do. So we would just drive out on country roads, find some abandoned place where no one would find us, and just hang out.
The two of you became really close friends. And at the same time, your life continued to kind of unravel. Mm-hmm. You know, you still had this feeling of being stalked by this mm-hmm. strange ghost, and you were getting more and more depressed. At some point, you began thinking about suicide?
Yeah, I had the unfortunate, you know, I was supposed to be a college student at the time, And one of the books we read was David Hume's Dialogues Concerning Natural Religion, which contained a couple posthumous essays as well. And one of them was about suicide. There was something, I'm going to mangle this quote, but it was something along the lines of, no one ever gave up a life that was worth keeping. He then goes on to say, basically, if you feel your life is not worth living, then that should be your biggest indicator that Providence has elected for you not to live it. All you're doing by not killing yourself is delaying the inevitable.
Kind of a toxic message to fall on the ears of a depressed teenager.
It is. And and to me, it became a justification for the way I felt. And what I felt was the answer to all of it was just to check out. So I acquired a little glass, a vial, a little clear plastic thing. And I bought a bunch of sleeping pills. And I carried them with me for months. Whenever I got into situations with people where I felt anxious or I didn't know what to do or people were upset with me, you know, I could reach in my coat pocket and I could feel that there and know that I had an automatic out whenever I needed it.
So it felt a little like a safety blanket in a way?
It felt like a choice. I always had a reason not to do it, but I always knew it was there.
Do you think you really would have?
If left unchecked, I would have, yeah. No one's ever asked me that directly, and I never really answered it out loud to myself, but that's the truth. Yeah, I would have.
What saved you?
An accident, literally and figuratively. I was up one morning very upset, and I got in my car, and I drove down the driveway, and I just remember like having this moment of just thinking, you know, F it. You know, I'm done. And I just hit the accelerator. The car hit the side of the house and the back steps, and it did almost no damage to the house. It tore the front wheel off the car. According to what I'm told, and I have no memory of this at all, I called my mother at work and said I had had an accident and that I was upset and, you know, wanted to die and all these other things. And she took me to the hospital. They asked me a series of questions, which I obviously answered incorrectly. And I was put in observation for 14 days, which ended up being a little longer than that.
From the way you tell the story in the book, it sounds like it was kind of your friend Laura who pushed you back into real life.
She gave me a reason to live because she never stopped caring about me. And it's not to say that nobody else cared about me, but I think everyone in my life was so frustrated and because they just didn't know what to do. I had kind of woven this web of deceit, so no one really even knew how bad off I really was. She kind of was the one who kind of never blinked, kind of stuck with me, even drove me home from the hospital.
So you've pulled your life together. But Laura herself has also become a ghost because you made it out of those teenage years, but she didn't.
Right, yeah.
What happened to her?
She left. She moved to New York for school, which I, at that time, considered a betrayal. I took it very poorly. We had tried on occasion to get together. We talked on the phone a little bit. She really didn't tell me much about her life. I knew she worked at a bookstore in New York. I knew she went to college. Then I ran into a friend one night outside of a bar. And we said, oh, let's talk. And she told me that Laura had been hit by a car and killed about a month before. What I learned when I wrote this book is actually those years, about 2 years between when she left and when she died, where she kind of went through her own version of what I did. She disappeared a couple times. When she finally left New York, she surfaced after a couple weeks in New Orleans. Refused to tell anybody why, how she'd even gotten there or what she was doing there, and would come home on the condition that no one ever asked her. And no one ever knew.
At the beginning, you said, really, your story is about what it's like to be haunted. And I was thinking, that's it, really, the feeling of being left with something that's unresolved with just a question, which is also the condition of life, isn't it?
It's interesting. We use ghosts as a cautionary tale for our own lives. And to understand and give ourselves hope, in a sense, that there's something afterwards. I spent a lot of time with spiritualists when I was writing this book, people who believe basically that mediumship is a vehicle to understand God and to connect to the dead, to the living, to have them be spiritual guides to the living. It's actually kind of a little bit of a kooky religion and very odd when you encounter it, and quite humorously odd. But the underlying tone of it is grief, people who go to spiritualism don't go there because they've had happy lives full of positive experiences. They go there because they've suffered loss or they've suffered death, and they want some sort of connection to understand that life as we know it or ourselves go beyond that. You know, the hardest thing for me to think about when I think of Laura is that she died in 1988, and to think of all that I've experienced since then, and that's all completely unknown and foreign to her. It just doesn't seem fair that a life would end. And just the idea that she might have some consciousness beyond that, be it as a ghost or otherwise, is somehow, as much as it's frightening to me, also kind of comforting to me.
Do you ever feel like it's partly your job to live well, to finish out the life that she didn't get to have?
Yes. For many years, I was kind of saddled with the belief that the wrong person had died out of that period, that she should have lived. And I don't allow myself to think of, what would she have thought of this? Would she like this band? How would she react to this happening? Because it seems such a false and bottomless pit of an idea. But the one thing I do walk away with is a sense of obligation that someone made an investment in me of her time, and that I owe it to her to make the best use of it.
Eric Newsom is Vice President for Programming at NPR and author of a memoir called Giving Up the Ghost. A few weeks ago, we invited listeners to send us 3-minute ghost stories. Here's what we got from Sophia Derbis in Mandeville, Louisiana.
He was 8 the first time he felt the spirit in the water. He had gone to the lake many times, swam, dived, loved that water with all his being. He felt the spirit when he sat at the edge of the dock and dipped his toes in the water. He felt the spirit course through his leg, up through his body, and wrap her arms around his neck. And he loved her, and she loved him. He spent the entire day in the water. He was 9 when he talked to the spirit. She sounded like the wind, quiet, fading in and out. She sounded like a whisper, and he couldn't tell what she said, but he felt her whisper to him, and he felt so proud. He sunk down to the bottom of the lake, curled his fingers in the mud, and he could breathe. He was 10, and the spirit lapped, restless at his head when he was in the water, at his feet when he left the water. He swam across the lake to the bottom again, but nothing was enough for her, and he felt the waves rising above him, and for a moment he was afraid. His parents pulled him out of the water, and he left her there, seething. He was 11 and told a story to his friends for Halloween. He told the story of a girl who hated the land so much that she tied rocks to her feet and became one with the water. He told the story of a dead girl who fell in love with a living boy, was jealous as she watched him grow, and decided to make him her own. That night, he slept more soundly than ever before. He was 12 and sat out on the dock. The water was calm and sad. He was 13 when the dock was flooded over completely. The lake overflowed to the land. The water consumed the land. And still, he walked out to it. He walked out to the lake, to the spirit of the water, to the giggling girl underneath it all, and he fell. Her arms wrapped around his neck, and he stayed. Voices whispered over the lake. They sounded almost like the wind.
A story from listener Sophia Derbis in Mandeville, Louisiana, read by our own Sarah Nix. Kind of makes you want to stay out of the water. Coming up, it's one thing to enjoy telling stories about ghosts, but it's another thing entirely to admit you believe them. How the paranormal became disreputable. And later this hour, Raymond Moody looks back on a life spent investigating near-death experiences. I'm Ann Strainchamps in for Jim Fleming, and this is To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. We're telling ghost stories in this hour, mostly fictional, but What if you've had an experience of something you think might really have been a ghost? Something you can't explain? If you're a regular listener, you know Steve Paulson is always interested in questions about the limitations of materialist science. So he really likes Jeffrey Kripal's recent book, Authors of the Impossible. It's an intellectual history of the paranormal.
Jeffrey, you are a historian of religion. Why did you get so interested in the paranormal?
Well, because I spent about 10 years in the late 90s and turn of the millennium studying something called the human potential movement. And during this time, I kept running into individuals who told me about extraordinary experiences that they had that I couldn't account for. And it was clear to me they weren't lying and they weren't making it up. And so I went back to the literature and to my own training and discovered with some dismay that I had nothing. I had no way to explain any of this because we had essentially erased it from the field, even though all of these terms originated among intellectuals in the 19th, early 20th century. We had essentially either forgotten them or suppressed them. No conspiracy theory here. It was just a historical observation.
And you're talking about people like William James?
William James, Frederick Myers, the London Society for Psychical Research. What happened in the 19th century around Cambridge was that a number of intellectuals were enamored, actually, of the new scientific methods, but they also thought that these weird anomalous events were real. And so they wanted to use the tools of science to study these anomalous experiences. And the assumption is that there were natural forces at work in these events that we simply didn't understand yet, but that someday we perhaps could.
You mentioned Frederick Myers, one of the people you write about.
Right.
Why are you interested in him?
Myers was a classicist at Cambridge University. He was an expert on Latin and Greek. He was the man who invented this new word, telepathy, which is an important word that's often misunderstood.
Wait, what is misunderstood about telepathy?
Well, when people hear the word telepathy, they think somebody trying to win a horse race or do well on the stock market or something silly. Where in fact, what the word means is profound emotion or profound suffering, pathos, at a distance, tele. And what Myers had in mind was these experiences were inevitably around death again. You know, the classic case was somebody would wake up in the middle of the night and they would see grandma or a child at the foot of the bed waving goodbye or dripping wet or something. And they would find out the next day or a couple days later that grandma or the child had died or drowned at more or less exactly that time. And so what Myers felt, what hit Myers and his colleagues like William James felt, was that what a telepathic communication was a profound state of fear and emotion and love and suffering that was somehow sending out signals on levels that we're not aware of, and that these signals would then surface as a dream or as a waking vision. And so what they had in mind, again, was these emotional connections of love. They weren't talking about predicting the stock market or a horse race.
So the question is what to make of these kinds of experiences, and lots of people say that they have had paranormal experiences, and scientists, of course, I mean the scientific establishment basically dismisses them out of hand. They say that these are examples either of quackery or gullibility. Where do we go from here?
Well, you know, the scientific method has advanced so far over the last few centuries precisely by removing the subjective, removing the mental component, and controlling simply the physical material world in very precise ways that can be predicted and measured. And so the problem with these experiences is they don't play by the rules of science. For one thing, they're clearly not just about material physical reality. The other rule they break is they're not repeatable. You can't get the sort of mind-blowing, spontaneous, life-changing experiences in the laboratory because A, they're almost always spontaneous, and B, they're usually around some trauma, some death, or some profound suffering event of a human being.
You're talking typically about once-in-a-lifetime experiences.
I am. And often these things, again, happen around the death of a loved one or one's own death or near death. And that isn't something we're going to replicate in a laboratory.
So your goal then is to help to try to create an intellectually safe space where you can study these very weird things?
That's my goal. I'm the humble little humanist in the corner raising his hand saying, well, what about this? What about that? What about this? And just trying to kind of fashion a way of talking about these things that isn't so polarized and isn't so dogmatic and that can listen to like real human beings talk about real experiences with a frankly, more compassion and more open-mindedness.
So how do you go about this? I mean, you are a professor at a prominent university, the chair of your religious studies department, right?
Right.
Do you invoke particular scholars who have credibility?
I use a lot of case studies from scientists who have had their own paranormal experiences and who have written about them in a very balanced way. And so that kind of breaks down this notion that, oh, it's just weird scholars of religion over here talking about this thing.
Who are some of these scientists we should know about?
Well, one of the strangest stories I've ever heard is from a biochemist named Kerry Mullis, who won the Nobel Prize for Biochemistry in 1993. He published an autobiography called Naked in the Minefield. I think that's the name of the book. But in one, he has a whole chapter, actually, on what looks a lot like an abduction experience. He had gone up to his cabin in California, and it was midnight, and he was walking to the outhouse to answer nature's call, and he came around a corner with his flashlight, and there was a glowing raccoon standing there, like literally glowing. And it said to him, good evening, doctor. And the next thing he knew, it was 6 hours later, and he was walking up a road towards his cabin without those 6 hours of memory. That was in 1976. In 1986, Whitley Strieber published his book on his own abduction experience called Communion. And both Mullis and his daughter immediately recognized something of their own experiences around that cabin in Strieber's book. And so there again, you have this resonance between an autobiographical account from a horror fiction writer of something that he claimed really happened, and you have that resonating with a Nobel Prize-winning biochemist.
Are we basically talking about consciousness and sort of trying to come up with a better way to think about this? Because, I mean, what you're obviously doing is you're challenging the standard neuroscientific model of consciousness, which is, you know, everything that happens in the mind comes from the physical mechanics of an individual's brain, and you simply can't explain a lot of this stuff, it would seem, using that model.
Right. This is why psychical experiences are rejected. Look, if a man knows that his grandmother is dying 1,000 miles away 2 hours before she dies, and he knows that instantly and definitively, we have no model for that, because in our model, we have to get that information into his skull somehow through a phone call or through a letter or something. We have no way of understanding how two separate individuals separated so far in space and time could be communicating. If, however, consciousness is not produced in toto by the brain inside a bony skull, if it in fact is located outside space and time, then there's absolutely nothing to prevent that communication from happening. In fact, you would expect exactly that kind of communication. So that's clearly the model there, or the hypothesis I'm moving toward. But again, I'm not a scientist. I'm a historian of comparative mystical literature. And that model works really, really well for me because it explains my data. It explains my literature.
Jeffrey Kripal is a historian of religion. His history of the paranormal is called Authors of the Impossible. And now, just in time for the election season, a ghost story from listener Eric Van Vliet in Marinette, Wisconsin.
The 24-hour news cycle did not know how to handle his return. President Marshall had come to power at a relatively young age. He gave the American people years of gleaming teeth and folksy phrases. When he finally passed away, They talked about revitalizing the $2 bill in his honor. Then, after a dignified and widely televised funeral, the nation slowly forgot him. Until his appearances began. The late President Marshall first appeared at a car wash in Dayton, Ohio, where Gladys Summerland was waiting to clean her Buick Skylark. She'd been one of his supporters, and seeing him again nearly gave her a heart attack. She sold her story to a tabloid for enough to visit her sister in Boca Raton. The late president was next spotted waving to onlookers at the Founders Day Parade in Fond du Lac, Wisconsin. After that, he appeared at a Basque restaurant in Elko, Nevada, where he made a speech about the enduring nature of Americans' appetite for success, and apparently also for mountains of mutton. The problem with the dead president's increasingly public presence was that the actual and presumably living candidates for his former office couldn't compete for media attention. With the election approaching its final months, the ghost of the former President Marshall began visiting the swing states. At an appearance in Springfield, Illinois, crowds asked him to summon Lincoln. Instead, he announced his own candidacy as a write-in. The other two candidates held closed-door meetings to discuss a possible alliance. With the reanimated former President Marshall polling so well, even if he didn't win, he could drastically skew results and upset the balance of power the two parties had fought so hard to entrench. Legal scholars declared that since the late president had evidently begun his second lifetime, he was entitled to another two terms. The ghost candidate won a whopping 70% of the popular vote, including many states his party hadn't won in decades. The two major party candidates vowed to find legal grounds for voiding the election, but the American people responded that they should concede, quit bellyaching, and give the ghost president a chance. Despite the spectacular circumstances, his inauguration was understated. Mainly, the ghost president just smiled and waved to the crowds. Afterwards, in the streets, people smiled a bit more and spoke more freely. It was clear that they had finally found the candidate they'd been looking for all along.
Thanks to Eric Van Vliet in Marinette, Wisconsin for that story, read by our friend Coleman. Next up, writer Dan Shaun reimagines the ghost story for a post-recession America. I'm Ann Strainchamps, in for Jim Fleming. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Dan Shaun is on a lot of people's short lists as one of the best novelists and short story writers working today. His new book of short stories is called Stay Awake. They're stories about scattered families and unfulfilled dreamers, people who are alive but feel like ghosts.
More and more, he thought, his days at the grocery store were like being in a zombie movie, except that here the undead appeared to be too depressed to be cannibals. You didn't even realize most of the time that they were dead. And he had the worrisome thought that he would look up and there would be his mom, or there would be he himself, Patrick Lane, gray-skinned and surprised-looking, standing at the end of an empty checkout aisle. It had occurred to him that if the undead don't realize that they are dead, he might easily be one of them himself.
So you were really drawn to the dark side from
early on. I was, and I don't quite know why, because I was a really scaredy kid. I was terrified of the dark.
I remember being so afraid of The Wizard of Oz that I had to watch it from outside the room. I'm standing in the door so that I could slip out whenever the witch showed up. But for some reason, at the same time, I was really like magnetically drawn to this sort of scary stuff. And I think it had to do with wanting to find a way to conquer it, or at least to know it.
So people are talking about this new book as a collection of ghost stories, and you've talked about it too that way, but we're not talking about, you know, the white ghost and the sheet kind of thing.
No, so not I don't think there's even anything supernatural that happens in most of the stories.
But would you still call this a collection of ghost stories?
To me, ghosts have to do with the things that we can't quite escape, even though they're not tangible. I think a lot about the people that we were in the past and whether those people still exist in some way. I also think about the ways in which we try to escape our pasts, and I think those pasts contain ghosts for all of us.
He had been a different person back then, a drunk, a monster. At 18, he married the girl he'd gotten pregnant and then had set about slowly, steadily ruining all their lives. When he'd abandoned them, his wife and son, back in Nebraska, he had been 24, a danger to himself and others. Years later, when he was sober, he wanted to own up to his behavior, to pay the back child support, to apologize, but they were nowhere to be found.
We should talk about, for example, the first story in the book, mm-hmm. Bees.
Yes.
The setting is in some ways the most mundane kind of setting you could imagine. This character is, what, he drives a truck for UPS?
He's a UPS driver, yeah. He's just married. His wife's a nurse. They've had a kid. They're really pretty happy, except then their son starts having these night terrors, I guess you would call them. He wakes up screaming, and this brings up a secret that the main character has been hiding, which is that when he was younger, he had another family that he had abandoned.
Doesn't know if they're alive or dead,
but begins to feel very certain that the son that he abandoned is out to get him.
In the dream, DJ is older. He looks to be 19 or 20, and he walks into a bar where Gene is hunched on a stool sipping a glass of beer. Gene recognizes him right away, his posture, those thin shoulders, those large eyes. But now DJ's arms are long and muscular, tattooed. There is a hooded, unpleasant look on his face as he ambles up to the bar, pressing in next to Gene. DJ orders a shot of Jim Beam, Gene's old favorite. "I've been thinking about you a lot, ever since I died," DJ murmurs. Gene puts a trembly cigarette to his mouth and breathes on it, choking on the taste. He wants to say, "I'm sorry, forgive me," but he can't breathe. DJ shows his small, crooked teeth. "I know how to hurt you," DJ whispers.
And then I won't give away what happens, but it's very, very creepy.
Good things don't happen, generally, in this book.
So I wanted to ask you about creating the atmosphere of a ghost story, because, you know, we were talking about America being haunted. I think you see that even in the American landscape, at least in the landscapes that you create in these stories. Is that something you really thought about consciously?
Well, I'm drawn to that kind of landscape, and I grew up in western Nebraska, which has a really stark kind of beauty, but also a sense of emptiness and inhospitality. I think about the town where I grew up, which was a little grain elevator town on the Union Pacific Railroad line. I Google mapped it recently, and it's not there. It's just not there.
So you come from a ghost town.
Well, and I live in one now. There are a couple of stories that are set in Cleveland post-economic bust 2008 disaster. And there's this sense of foreboding in these empty houses and overgrown lawns and boarded up storefronts that I see a lot of. And I know that the Cleveland Chamber of Commerce is going to hunt me down and kill me. But I love Cleveland. I'm not talking down on it. But there is something about that part of the landscape that's really inspiring to me and really interesting, even as it's kind of spooky.
Which makes me wonder, Is America haunted?
Oh, it's incredibly haunted. It's haunted by not only the things that we want to reinvent, but also by the things that we want to forget, that we don't want to talk about. And, you know, so much of our politics is about not talking about things.
So I wanted to ask about your personal reasons for being drawn to some of the themes that we've been talking about, kind of hauntedness and the ghosts of lives not lived or mm-hmm. lives past. You were adopted.
Yeah.
So is that the kind of thing you thought about as a kid? Were you one of those kids who lay awake and thought about what other life could I be living?
Yeah. Well, I think that's sort of the condition of being adopted in some ways, is that it asks you to think about some of the questions that other people don't necessarily have to think about, although I think it applies to everyone. I mean, I could have been adopted by any number of people. Would I have been a different person? Would I have had a different life arc than I do?
And we're raised by different parents at different stages of our lives.
Yeah.
You know, it's not as though our parents are the same people all the way through, are they?
Do you ever have that, like, weird realization when you're hanging out with your kids and you think, oh, my mom was this age when she was hanging out with me, and this is what it felt like to be her? And suddenly you see them in a very different light. That's another kind of ghost, I guess. Mm-hmm. You get to see the ghost of your mom as she really was, or as she maybe was experiencing, instead of mom, which is a completely different relationship.
So far we've been talking about the creepier side of ghosts, but you mentioned you also lost your wife. I know she died a few years ago from cancer. Did that change for you? Did it bring you new sorts of thoughts about ghosts?
Well, I think that losing my wife has been sort of like a defining thing for me in the last few years, and has really altered the way that I exist in the world. I think the saddest aspect of it is that I didn't really get to see her ghost, or I haven't yet. You know, I expected that in some ways it would be the most natural thing that I would see her. And in some ways the most unnatural thing is not seeing her. She's just not there.
She was a writer.
Yeah, she was a writer.
A writing teacher, your writing teacher.
She was my writing teacher. We were actually together since I was 19. Basically, my entire adult life was spent with Sheila. And we shared a lot of things. We shared, you know, a sense of humor, a sense of, you know, of the importance of writing. We were both teachers. We were one another's biggest fans.
But I was wondering if, I mean, what you do have is her books.
I do have
her
books.
She was a short story writer, and she published her first novel, sadly, posthumously, came out after she died. But you have all those stories, which you must read and reread, find new things in.
Yeah. I'm actually in the process of editing her last short story collection, which she was working on when she died. It actually took me longer than I feel was proper to get the guts to go back and start editing it. It was pretty hard. I mean, I think it's getting to a point where you can go back to those stories as if you're visiting the lost person. For a long time, it was too hard to visit because you knew that you couldn't stay.
Yeah.
You mean they weren't really going to come back with you. I'm just thinking that sales of antidepressants are going to rise after this episode of To the Best of Our Knowledge has aired.
Well, but I think the point of your of what we've been saying and of your fiction is that the state of being haunted is not necessarily such a bad thing.
No, I don't, and I don't think it is. I think sometimes that is an American problem of thinking that it would be fantastic to be happy all the time. I don't think it would be fantastic to be happy all the time, because I think you need the other side of it to be really happy. And that part of going to this other place where you look at ghosts and you think about your own mortality and your own mistakes is one way to go back to your life right now and be happy and grateful for it.
Stay away. Don't nod and dream.
Stay Awake is the title of Dan Shaun's new book of short stories, and the title comes from Suzanne Vega's cover of the old Mary Poppins tune.
I'm haunted by the food I eat. How lame is that?
A ghost story from listener Jonathan Blythe.
I didn't understand last year why my apartment was slowly accumulating spectral barnyard animals. Phantom pigs rooting in my living room. Ghostly chickens foraging in the carpet. Seriously, ghostly chickens. There's a flock of them roosting in the laundry room now. I can't describe the feeling of seeing these hundreds of animals milling around my place, knowing I've eaten every one of them. It's not that they're spooky exactly, just that there's so many of them. I was lucky to be standing by the sink when a spectral squid flailed its tentacles out of the 6-quart pot in which I was boiling rigatoni for dinner, with meatballs. The cow will probably turn up one of these days. Of course, the first time a bear lumbered through the kitchen, I just about wet myself. When did I ever eat a bear? Then I remembered that super yummy homemade pepper sausage my neighbor Randall makes from wild game he hunts. Who knows what all goes in there? Anyway, that's how it is now. They're just part of my life, like memories, but more vivid. I could go on about the herds of cattle or the clams crusting the toilet bowl, but the real reason why I'm now strictly a vegetarian is this. 3 days ago, a girl showed up. 16, maybe. Pretty, with short brown pixie hair. The second I saw her, my mind reeled and I started to feel cold. My stomach began churning. She just looked at me, not angry, at least not at me, just serious, and said nothing. Neither do the tall black woman and boy of around 10 who arrived yesterday morning. I don't know where they came from, but I can guess. I just hope it wasn't the pepper sausage, because it was really good, know what I mean? I liked it.
Thanks to Wisconsin listener Jonathan Blythe for that story, read by Stephen Montagna. And our last interview in this hour is a conversation Steve had recently with Raymond Moody, the famously controversial psychiatrist who coined the term near-death experience. Moody spent nearly 40 years studying death and dying, trying to figure out what happens after death. He's reached the age to look backward a bit, which he does in a new memoir called Paranormal: My Life in Pursuit of the Afterlife.
Well, let's start at the very beginning. When did you first get interested in near-death experiences?
Well, my big hero in life, I got to say, is Plato. I was not raised in a religious family. I was went to the University of Virginia at age 18. The first philosophy course I took, just within literally the first few days, reading Plato's Republic, I was hooked. And the Republic culminates in the experience of a warrior named Ur, who was believed dead on the battlefield, but inconveniently sat up at his funeral and told his colleagues about moving away from his body through passageways into another world in which he saw his life reviewed. This was a very well-known phenomenon among the early Greek philosophers. They called these people the revenants, who were popularly believed to have died and come back. But I thought this was just a Greek idea. And in 1965, 3 years later, I heard that Dr. George Ritchie, who was a professor of psychiatry at UVA at that time, had been pronounced dead twice some years before. I went to a student group where he was talking about this, and I was blown away. I got my PhD in philosophy at the age of 24, and I started teaching philosophy, and very quickly began to hear these stories from students and from my fellow faculty members. And then the word spread in this little town about, oh, this professor over there is talking with people who almost died. And then these...
Wait, so you're saying that back when you were teaching philosophy, you had not even become a psychiatrist yet, and you were already talking with people about near-death experiences?
Oh, yes, I got into this not from the medical angle, but from the philosophy angle. So these movers and shakers in this little town, you know, the respectable businessmen in these clubs, I never went to one of these things. That there weren't, after my talk, one or two, or in one case, seven of these men came up, and all introducing themselves with the same words. It's like, Dr. Moody, I've never told anybody this, but... So by about 1970, I was saying, whoa, this is something here that has been missed.
But this is fascinating because, I mean, this is really before the whole idea of near-death experiences was in the public consciousness. I mean, in fact, you're the one who coined the word near-death experiences.
Yes. When I was still in medical school, I kept lecturing on this to medical societies. And unbeknownst to me, at one of these meetings, there was a very nice young reporter there. And to my astonishment, a very accurate rendition of what I had said appeared in a newspaper. A publisher called me and asked me if I would do a book on it.
Now, there are scientific explanations for these. There was a book that I've just seen recently trying to explain all of this through basic brain chemistry, saying that these experiences are triggered by lack of oxygen, that field of vision sort of starts to go, which might explain the experience of light, and it might be inducing some sort of REM state. Can we explain this from the perspective of neuroscience?
Most of the people who write these books allegedly explaining these experiences neurophysiologically don't actually talk to patients. They read sort of secondhand accounts and then speculate. But perhaps more importantly, all of the elements that we identify as a near-death experience also occur quite frequently to the bystanders at the bedside of somebody else who does die.
Wait, so you're saying that someone, let's say my mother is dying, I might share her experience somehow?
Oh, yes. Yes, absolutely. People at the bedside, for example, may tell us that at the point somebody dies, they see what seems to be a transparent replica of the person, sort of stand up and move away from the body. Other people tell us that as their loved one died, that they themselves exit their body and they accompany their dying loved one partway toward this light. People commonly describe the light filling up the room as somebody is passing away, or saying that they perceive the spirits of the dying person's dead relatives and friends sort of coming into the room to take them away. And most remarkably of all, have cases where the bystanders empathically co-lived the dying life review of the person who passed away. And so the bystanders, not being ill or injured, there's no question there of compromised blood flow to their brain, and yet they report the same experience.
How many stories like this have you heard? I mean, are you talking a few? Are you talking many?
I'm sure by now many hundreds. First one of these I heard was from one of my own medical school professors in 1972 or 73, who had an experience like this when she was resuscitating her mother. And then throughout the 70s and 80s, I began to hear about them. I was getting ready to write this up in 1994, and incredibly right at that same time, my mother died, and my wife and I and my family, we were there, and we had this experience. I don't think a demographic study has been done yet, but I'm fairly confident in predicting that if such a study were done, that what it would show was that these empathic or shared death experiences are as common or perhaps even more common than near-death experiences.
So you said you had one of these experiences. When your mother died, can you describe what happened?
Well, as my mother was dying, we were no longer in three-dimensional space. I know that sounds crazy, but then I can find hundreds of other people who have had that same experience. These are very inadequate words, but it's as though that suddenly, rather than being in a three-dimensional cubicle, which is like a hospital room, it was like we were in this funnel, or if you had two inverted funnels that were connected at the narrow end, and we were in this surging, whirling space of energy and light. Now, I say light because that's the closest thing to it, but it's not light. It's love, or I don't know. Words are failing me.
Can you explain this? I mean, what do you think is going on?
I don't know. Probably we don't have the cognitive equipment to make sense of this. You know, I've always been very comfortable with saying, I don't know. I mean, we don't know how to explain these experiences. That's the fact.
You know, what you've been talking about, I think the vast majority of neuroscientists would say, is not possible. Is what you're talking about, is this in the realm of science, or have we left science here?
We haven't yet arrived at science. You know, if you look at the history of science, all sorts of questions that initially weren't thought of as scientifically resolvable eventually make it in. But before they do, there's usually a conceptual revolution. Well, I think that's where we are with the afterlife question.
Okay, you have talked with hundreds, thousands of people who've had these near-death experiences. Do you think there will be a Raymond Moody after your physical body dies, or a Raymond Moody in some sense of a distinct entity?
I've never liked the name Raymond anyway. And it's the thing that seems most highly implausible to me about the performances of mediums, for example, is that it's almost an insult to me that Uncle John could be brought back from the beyond with his proper name. Now, if you think about it, what that implies is that a proper name is a transcendental part of speech. That's a leap for me. I think that your ego identity is, I'm not anticipating having that anymore, no.
Raymond Moody talking with Steve about his new memoir, Paranormal, My Life in Pursuit of the Afterlife.
What's the use of having muscles when your life hangs by a thread? If you ain't got no red corpuscles, Jack, you dead. You've been always kicking, but you stubbed your toes when you ups and kicks to bucket, just like old man Mose. When you get no kicks from loving and you blow your top instead, it's a fact that you ain't living, Jack, you dead.
And that's it for To the Best of Our Knowledge, the Undead Edition. Because nothing ever dies on the internet, this hour lives on as a podcast and interviews you can share with friends, book and music listings. You'll find it all at ttbook.org. We had lots of help this hour. Joe Hartke and Aubrey Ralph produced our listener ghost stories, which were read by Sarah Nix, Peter Sobel, Stephen Montagna, and Coleman. Our producers are Sarah Nix, Charles Monroe Kane, Doug Gordon, and Veronica Rickert. Technical director Kirill Owen rules the dark shadows of the studio. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson, and I'm Ann Strangechamps. Jim Fleming will be back next week.
If you just ain't got nobody since you gone and lost your head, rigor mortis or set in daddy, Jack, you dead. All the breath has leaked out of you. When your friends gather around the bed and look at you and say, don't he look natural? When that happens to you, daddy, Jack, you dead.
PRI, Public Radio International.